Good morning. Welcome to this panel discussion. Just to make sure you're in the right place, this is Working Hard to Write Well, How You Too Can Accumulate Scar Tissue. My name's Keith Phillips. I'm headmaster at Schaefer Academy in Rochester, Minnesota, and I'll be moderating this panel discussion today, and I'll have our panel members introduce themselves now.
I'm Ryan Baker, teach at Cary Christian School.
Ty Fisher, I'm the headmaster of Veritas Academy in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
I'm Dan Doherty, and I teach at Schaefer Academy in Rochester, Minnesota.
These guys are each going to give about a four-minute introduction to their topic. While they're doing that, there are on your chairs, I believe, index cards, note cards. If you have questions for them, we should have about 45 minutes for questions in this session. So if you could just please write your questions, write a particular panel member's name on the question if you would like them to answer that question. If not, we'll pick who will answer that. For most questions, we won't have everyone answer the question. So write the name of the panelist and your question, and we'll try to get through as many of those as possible. With that said, take it away.
Well, I'm sure we all know that writing well takes considerable time, effort, and revision. I say that ultimately we're here to help our students to think clearly and foundationally. Providing a proper structure is one of the important things that we can do for them. This structure, as I have seen, does not inhibit or bind them initially. Rather, it helps them to order their thoughts and develop their creativity. In the English literature classroom, they should be writing in many different formats. But for the sake of this discussion, I am focused primarily on the more formal, expository writing, where students develop ideas and arguments as they respond to characters, themes, authors, worldviews. In the freshman year, which is primarily where I've taught for several years, we actually begin with the body paragraph of an essay, which seems to regress because they've been doing this for a while. But developmentally, I find that this is really the stage and in the age where they start to pick up some very important things about the expository essay, namely that they are learning how to make their points personal, their own, very individual. And it's a good waking up period. So we begin with the body paragraph. And as they learn to develop this part, the intro and the conclusion will come. We begin with the idea of credibility as a writer. And I link this idea to their writing in order to help them see the importance of ordering words for the purpose of revealing some aspect of the truth. They are, after all, after the truth. And they should strive to represent reality through their writing with clarity and power. To do this, I begin with a simple acronym that I created, and I've called it PIE, P-I-E. It's an acronym that gives them a little bit of structure for a body paragraph. P in the acronym stands for point, I stands for illustration, and E stands for explanation. The point holds the idea of the paragraph and usually begins it. The illustrations of the paragraph, which are typically text examples or facts, and there should be at least two, support the idea and formulate the beginning of the proof. The explanations form that portion of the paragraph where the writer offers his interpretation of the text or facts and moves to explain how that illustration shows the point. Simply stated, good writing makes a point, proves it with supporting facts and an interpretation of those facts. This begins the process, which seeks to uncover strong, rich content and the ordering of ideas, which both help to develop style and voice. There are many specific methods for approaching writing, many. My hope with this PIE acronym is to initiate a process which I use to push the students to make their points personal and real, their illustrations subtle yet strong, and their explanations clear, insightful, and developed. Thank you.
This morning, when I got up, I'm with some of my staff here, and they were asking what I was going to do today, and I said I was going to be on this writing panel. And some of them asked, like, why? Why are you going to be on the writing panel? And I said, I always say yes to everything they ask me to do. I'm a board member for the associations. So I feel like I have to. Then I try to think, like, logically, how did I get here? And I think it's because, number one, I bring an administrative perspective. So I think I had something to do with the name with scar tissue here, because if you're a teacher and you teach writing, you know what that's about. If you're an administrator and you try to get teachers to teach how to write, you don't sleep much trying when you think about that. And then I've written a lot. I was the managing editor of the Omnibus curriculum, which is more words than I think biblically should be written. I actually wrote more words than should be biblically written in the explanation that you have in front of you in the notebook, because I had to chop them out. So there's one dangling sentence in there, so I'll unpack it. So you say, like, you come to the writing workshop, and it says, in the middle here, the first two are, as best I can tell, patently false. But then I don't go really on to say anything after that. Well, here's what I was going to say. The first thing here is this, that we can skip or heckle any writing teachers at the conference that claim that writing is fun or easy, okay? Now, I would set Andrew Pudua aside from this because maybe he just sounds fun when he does it. But the process is hard. It's difficult. Good writing hurts both the student and the teacher. It hurts the teacher because helping students write well takes a lot of feedback and a lot of grading. It hurts the student because getting down to good writing means stripping away a lot of pride. There is a linguistic relationship between the word humility and humiliation. It starts with a recognition that almost all early writing, even from very bright students, stinks. My career as a writer began in college when one of my teachers, the Reverend Dr. Barbara Aiken, actually threw one of my papers at me after yelling something like that it was beneath her to read any more of it. This was shocking to me because I had always received, I'm a pack rat, so I have my old papers from high school and stuff. So I know the grades that I made in high school, and they are almost all A's. And as I go back and read them now, the papers are not written in a language called English. I don't know if they were trying to encourage me, but Dr. Aiken, God bless her, finally woke me up. Her judgment was just. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you think kids carry everything from grammar school over into secondary school, that's a mythology. How many of you are grammar school teachers here? Okay, how many secondary teachers? Okay, how many administrators? Okay, thank you. Great, I'm glad some of you are here. Grammar school teachers hate secondary school teachers and how they teach writing. Grammar school teachers, you're prideful. You're prideful, and this is the reason. Because secondary teachers don't just get to sit with the kids and just teach writing to them. I put this down over to the side because I'm thinking a lot about it now as we work to get our writing better. Your secondary program is as weak as your weakest teacher who writes or who makes the kids write. And that's scary. That's scary. Like, I'm talking about your science teacher, your math teacher. They don't carry everything across from grammar school to secondary school. Why chase the elusive white stag of writing well? Why suffer all this pain? Because writing well is the payoff of a classical education, classical Christian education. If your teachers and students can learn to tolerate, work through, and eventually enjoy writing, they might just write words that will change worlds, or as Doug said this morning, make worlds. And we could really use a little bit of that. So my diagnosis administratively is this. The first of the seven laws of teaching is that you have to know what you teach. Most of our teachers don't know how to write well. They don't write well, in fact.
And most administrators are as lost in judging their writing as I'm lost in our second year calculus classes. That we're going to have to. This is a very, very important thing. And I don't want to say I'm not going all. I'm not despairing. Okay, my kids. The fun thing is I note here that my kids go off to college every year and they tell me how much better a writer they are than the other kids that, you know, got patted on the back for writing in Ebonics or something like that during high school. But we have a lot of work to do in this area, and I wish I had silver bullets and, what did I say, holy grails to pass out to you. If I did, I would probably package them and try to sell them to you, but I don't have those things. So hope we can learn a little bit together.
Good stuff. I want my students to understand the theology of words, the purpose of grammar, the process of writing. And I also do want them to find joy in wordplay, and I think that is possible eventually. The theology of words. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words have eternal consequences. The world is made of words. You and I are made of words. God speaks and we exist. We're the image of that very God, and naming is an act of power and dominion, as Doug said this morning. When we fulfill the cultural mandate with words, we are imitating the Creator God and fulfilling our ontological purpose as the Imago Dei. Satan has no such ability. He only twists words. Through him, the spoken word was twisted. The word made flesh redeemed the words made flesh, lowercase w there, second one. We have a choice to make with our words to pervert or create, to tear down or redeem. The purpose of grammar, I want my students to understand. For years, students learn that grammar is simply pointing at a word and labeling it or chanting those labels. When I mention the word grammar in ninth grade, hopefully by 10th grade, I've weeded through some of this, involuntary groans rise to their lips. When I ask why, many of them tell me that they see grammar as nothing more than busy work. They have not yet realized that grammar is to writing as a palette and brushes are to painting. The more they understand about blending their words, the more effective and enjoyable will be the writing process. They've not yet realized that grammar is to writing as passing drills and wind sprints are to the big game. Very few really look forward to the drills. Very few people look forward to the drills. But athletes do them willingly because they understand their purpose. Students who learn to associate their understanding of grammar with the taste of victory, of an essay well written, will be more willing to do the drills. We must make it very plain to them that the drills are directly connected to the game and not an end in and of themselves. Too often they don't see that learning grammar has to do really with writing. as obvious as that seems, so many of my students kind of, oh, yeah, okay. When they see the connection between weak verbs, unnecessary prepositional phrases, passive voice, and nominalizations, they'll begin to be able to diagnose the mystery of their clumsy and wordy sentences. When they experience the power of a strong verb in a concrete subject, they'll delight in concise prose. And when finally they learn how to show rather than tell, how to use similes and metaphors, how to frame quotes and effectively paraphrase, they will think of themselves as writers, and grammar will be a tool of their trade, not a byword on their lips. The process of writing. My students do much of their writing in class so that I can walk them through the process. I give them homework points for simply turning in a page of invention. I leave room on tests for them to do invention before they write their essays. Students need to learn to think before they write. They need to apply all that they've learned in Bible, logic, worldview, history, math, science, all that they've learned from family and church to whatever questions they explore through their writing. They need to learn how to find credible sources, not just books. When it comes to arrangement, they need to understand that a paper can be thought of in terms of its parts, but the process should not be formulaic. I want them to look at the canon of arrangement in much the same way they might look at a new box of Legos. The first time you open the box, you follow the instructions provided. This ensures that your efforts will render a creation that uses all of the parts and looks the way it should. A master builder, however, if anybody's, everything is awesome. A master builder, however, is not content to simply do what has always been done or to stop at the point of mimicking others. A master builder will take apart his creation, consider other viable ways of putting it together, and finally, using all of his previous Lego experience and the principles of sound design, make something all his own. The first several times he does this, of course, his creation will not be perfect. In fact, probably horrible. It will not be perfect, but the more he understands the design or purpose of each piece, the exordium, the amplification, the thesis, the proofs, the narrative, etc., the better equipped he will be to put together his essay in a way that is not formulaic, but rather suits his particular context and audience. And lastly, and very briefly, I want my students to enjoy wordplay. Even students who have difficulty buying into all the above love it when we play Balderdash. And they love it when we play our own version of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me's Bluff the Listener Challenge, essentially an extended version of Two Lies and a Truth. And if they enjoy wordplay in one context, I find it's bound to spill over into others.
Thank you. If you have questions written down, would someone mind volunteering to go? Thanks, Ryan. If you could just hand those to the middle aisle, and those will be brought up. But while we're collecting those, I have a question, and this question actually would be nice for all three to answer. Writing takes time. How do you best manage homework times, given the goal of developing effective writers? And I think this isn't my question, but I'd say to flesh it out, we don't want to kill the students. We don't want to grind the students up with just overloading them with work. But we do want them to learn to write well and think well and do many other things well. So how do we do that? How do you do that?
At my school, we send the students home with reading, but not with writing. So a lot of the writing happens, all of the writing happens in the classroom, as Dan said. And I think that this is a very good thing to do because it's easy to come alongside of them. I've found primarily in the grading of essays, because it can be overwhelming, that I can communicate in a one-on-one conference with a student a lot more than I can in 2 minutes than I can in scouring an essay with whatever color ink I'm using. And so it's a good opportunity to call students up in the process of while they write and communicate with them, to look at pieces and parts of their essays. It's not necessarily that you can look at the whole thing and get a feel for where the student's going. Oftentimes, after grading essays for a long time, after reading just a few sentences, we can understand a little bit about where they're going, where they're struggling, and help them with that. So I would say that managing homework at Carey Christian School, it's just a matter of giving them the right amount of reading, and then in class, they're either engaging that reading through discussion or writing. And so that's where it comes in.
I think unless there's a kind of a class devoted to writing, we have a ninth grade composition class and a one semester junior thesis class and then a year-long senior thesis class at Veritas. Unless there's a class like that, a lot of our writing assignments, especially in Omnibus, we try to keep very, very short so that the teacher is not discouraged to really edit the work. We've also done some work at some points of trying to help the other students edit their fellow students' work, because the skills of an editor are really ones that help you. The hardest writing to edit for me is my own writing. So try to keep those things short so the teacher can have a lot of time to edit and interact.
What they said, pretty much. short, I want to reiterate both of those things, I guess, is that writing in class, fantastic to look over the shoulders and to watch. Oh, you're doing the same. Remember, we talked about that before. You're doing the same thing. But also short, there is definitely profit in learning how to put together an extended essay later. Down the road, but early on especially, I think short pieces, how many times do I want to write on the same paper, show, don't tell, show, don't tell, show, don't tell? All I need is a paragraph to know that they don't know how to show and not tell. And so early on, short pieces.
also with my teachers, especially when you get to midterms and finals in classes like Omnibus at Veritas, you have to take this into account. If you really don't give the kids a time in a test to craft their writing, don't kill them. Don't kill them on the grading side when you haven't really given them. You've given them just enough time to get an answer down. So what you're doing, there's a little bit of boiling kids in the mother's milk there. Yeah.
Thanks. This one, you guys can either all answer again or pick. How does the lost tools play into this discussion?
I'm assuming you mean the lost tools of writing or the lost tools of learning. Which one are you talking about?
It doesn't say. Whoever wrote this, you want to clarify your question?
The lost tools of writing. Okay, the Searcy Institute stuff. How many are familiar with Andrew Kern and Searcy Institute materials? For me personally, 8 years ago, I went to a Searcy. I heard Andrew Kern speak and gained a lot of insight in the way that he has kind of reappropriated, or not even that much just kind of in many ways popularized Aristotle's first three canons of rhetoric and the topics. A lot of that comes from most of what's in there is packaged from other sources, which is most of what is good about in education, right? It's talent borrows, genius steals, right? Never mind, it was Nietzsche that said that. I use some of that framework. However, that particular curriculum, while it may be wonderful for homeschooling, I'm not sure, I don't homeschool, but it's more packaged that way. It's very difficult to do exactly what he has, there are plenty of, as I have in my some other materials there in my little paragraph in your book, Scott Kreider uses a very similar framework in The Office of, anyone know what's the name of that book? The Office of Persuasion, I think is what it's called. But a very similar breakdown. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Okay, this one would be for everyone as well. I think it's the last one for everyone. How does one best maintain the balance between humbling their students with criticism, like what Ty mentioned possibly, and crushing their spirits?
I think that the equation works something like this, that you try to do as much as you can do, but you have to, a wise teacher has to think about the context of love within the relationship with the student. And if the student knows you love them and care about them, you can say pretty hard things to them and they can listen and they'll cry. I mean, but it's okay. There's crying at school. That's fine, and you're not gonna get to be a good.
Crying is fun, but writing is not fun. Yeah. Is that okay?
No, crying's not fun. It's okay. It's okay. But I think that that context of love can help you get further. And then I think that a wise teacher just has to manage how far they can push and not push a student, because you don't want them to give up. But you do want them. You're not going to get them there without them having to work hard.
Other guys, same answer. So Ty, the example you gave though, did that teacher have the relationship with you? You took it well, or was that how'd that go?
Well, I would say this too, that I don't know if I was typical or not. I had an okay relationship with Dr. Aiken. But I don't think she cared. And honestly, I'm the kind of guy, the most meaningful, like, philosophical changes in my life come at the end of a 2x4. And people say, well, that sounds really mean. And really, it's the only way I would have understood it. So I think that, you know, and I don't know if, some of my guys tend to be a little bit more bullheaded. And you kind of do. You just have to pick up a shovel and hit them with it, and they'll be okay. They'll be okay. So that was the only thing that worked for me.
Okay. This question's for you as well, Ty. Do you believe that students should be writing across subjects? If so, should all teachers hold students to the same standards of expectations? example, responding to a Bible passage, writing about a scientist and his accomplishment?
Yeah. The answer is yes, and this is what caused my innate premillennialism here to bubble up at the beginning, because it just doesn't sound very hopeful, because that getting your science teacher and your math teacher to fit essay questions in there, and then to get them to grade them as if they're writing teachers. This is why the grammar school teachers can be prideful. They oversee the whole writing of all of the student. For the secondary teacher, even the writing teacher, it's not like they're even reading most of the writing that the student's doing at our school. So I do think that kind of trying to get down to bedrock of what you're working on, maybe at particular grade levels, and having rubrics that your teachers would use, and then administrators forcing or encouraging and then forcing teachers, even outside of the normal writing subjects, to encourage writing that fits into what you're really trying to work on.
As teachers as well, it doesn't have to come from the top down. The history teacher that teaches next to me, Rich Harris, he and I talk often, and he's asking me all the time, what are these tools that you're using? How do I explain this in this history paper? I want them to do this. How do I explain that? And over these conversations, we've teamed up. So as he's having them write a cause and effect paper, he wants to know, I don't want this background stuff that they often put in the beginning. I want that a little farther down. What do we call that? Oh, that's the narrative. Okay, so if I told them to put the narrative here, they're going to get, so we have these discussions, and then I'll sit in on his class and kind of help him to teach the writing process of the history, and we'll do papers together, and he'll grade the history portion, and I'll grade the writing portion and that sort of thing. So I think as teachers, you could take some initiative and team up with one another.
If I could follow up on that question, just to clarify, because in any room like this, there's some people that are brand new to this and some people that are more experienced, and I think often the new folks can get overwhelmed and discouraged. I don't think you guys are saying, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you're saying every class, every subject needs to have the same quantity of writing as part of their objectives.
No.
But when they write, if you have them write an essay, or if then hold them to that standard.
Yeah.
But am I correct, guys?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So those of you that are new, we're not saying in our experienced schools, at least most of us, that every class is nothing but essay questions. Every class is nothing but long writing assignments. And every teacher must grade at the same level. But when we do that, it should be thoughtful and across the subjects, and certain standards should be upheld. Is that a fair summary?
Okay. Yep.
All right. This is for Dan Doherty. Should grammar be taught at the 9th through 12th grade levels? What drills should they be practicing, etc.?
Great question. Not so much drills. I think that would, I don't use any drills. I want to see them understanding, hopefully, the grammar. The goal, of course, is that grammar would be known by the time they get to 9th grade so that we can manipulate it. So when I say this sentence is in parallel, instead of you have two infinitives and one participial, you should have three infinitives here, they don't go, a what? However, that doesn't. I find in the junior high years there's some brain slippage, and we need review. And so, but the reviewing, I don't think doing more drills is going to help them to make that connection. So rather than reviewing with drills, I do a lot of explaining why we even use the terms that we do, which I'd love to see happen earlier. Actually, I'd love to see grammar. And logic teachers teaching more of why is it called a predicate nominative, because it renames nomen, the subject, that sort of thing, so we understand why is this label the label, so that it sticks a little harder. But I'll help them to understand why these things do what they do in the context of the writing itself, but not through a bunch more drills, which I think would be counterproductive.
Ryan, what are your recommendations to help make the grading of writing more objective?
Yeah, rubrics are good. And how you develop the rubric and how you break the rubric down is going to be important. And what I really strive for when I build a rubric and I have a colleague makes, really develops excellent rubrics. It's an excellent opportunity in feedback to actually teach writing. And so it has to be clear. The objectives that you state on the rubric have to be clear, because you're going to use those as a part of the language of the course to communicate to them where they're falling short, whether they are assuming that they're saying something that they're actually not saying, whether they're telling you something that you want them to show you. These rubrics should be built in such a way where they understand when you give a 3 in a category instead of a 5, how it is that you arrived at the 3. And there can be a quick process of communication for that, or just simply a few underlining of words that you use consistently in class. That's one of the primary ways, I think, to do it. I find, personally, the writing conference to be highly, highly effective, and it's a great opportunity to encourage the students, because they can be broken down pretty easily when it comes to, scar tissue, right? When it comes to communicating to them, you're really not saying what you think you're saying. And so it's important to help them to see that in a statement. I've developed a lot of little shorthand comments, but in a statement, it's still unclear if your average student is getting it. And that's really the target, right? I mean, we're not trying to, we're trying to effectively communicate to those students that are in the middle. Are they getting it? Are they understanding it? Are they growing? So I would say rubrics and conferences are important.
Ty, from an administrative standpoint, how do you achieve uniform writing standards and techniques throughout the school? Is there a preferred curriculum that does a great job 7th through 12th? And no shameless plugs.
No,
go ahead.
No, I don't have one. I look at them all the time. I don't believe there is one.
Hey guys, can you hold that mic close to you? There are you hearing that?
I don't believe there is one.
I don't think I've accomplished that. I'll be honest with you. This is the thing that at the end of every school year, I kind of wrinkle my brow and take stock of what we did. I think our senior thesis papers this year were the best senior thesis papers we've ever produced at our school. So I was happy with that. But this is a haunting question. I don't know. One of my nightmares is out here in the audience. But it's that question of how do you get everybody to do the same thing? And sometimes I can't even get my teachers to agree on the rules of grammar. You know, they shout at each other over those things. And that's like, you give them a rubric and they start crossing things out. That's no good. You can't do that. You can't do that. You have to be uniform. And in some ways, I think that's a thing that we just kind of, I think, like, next year, here's my plan for next year, is to try to have more time, especially for my secondary teachers, during faculty meeting to talk about these things and to kind of get on the same page. But I don't think I've accomplished what the question is asking me to give.
Do either of you other guys have a curriculum you think is helpful to that end? Or same answer?
Lost Tools is a great beginning place for me.
Lost Tools is a great beginning place.
Yeah.
But there is no magic bullet, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think if I can weigh in, I think you want some institutional uniformity to a degree in order that the students kind of know what to expect, but I don't think we're trying to create absolute uniform. That would kind of go against some of what we're also trying to teach. Would you guys agree? I mean, we don't want them all to write exactly the same when they are done, right?
Well, it's not a content, it's a skill.
Right.
It's like you'd say, like, well, How do you teach uniformly? I'm from Indiana. How do you teach a kid to play basketball? Well, if he's 5 foot tall, you teach him one way, and if he's 7 foot three, you teach him to do something else.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit more difficult than just like a history book where you're trying to take facts and ask questions and those kinds of things. It's a harder thing.
Thanks. Dan, how do you instill a love of writing in your students, especially in an age where more and more say that they won't need it since they want to be engineers or software programmers or, in our town, physicians, right? They won't need to write.
Great question. I personally, part of it, I think, is I love it. And I love writing, and I love teaching writing, and I think I really do think that they catch that. I don't think I'm too naive, you know, to think, oh, just because I love it, they do. But I really think that they catch that. Helping them to see that they want to communicate, no matter if they're going to have to write papers, they do want to communicate, and they want they help them to understand that there are things in life that they want. So using real life examples, maybe it's can I have the keys to the car, and use an example of a persuasive way and a non-persuasive way to go about asking mom and dad for the keys to the car. And wouldn't you like to be a little more skilled in your persuasion abilities? So I think helping them to understand that communication is a part of life.
Go ahead. Yes.
Real quick. Two other things that I think are really important are, number one, having them soak in really good literature so that they can see the power of what well-written stuff actually does. And the second thing is, when somebody writes something that's halfway decent, praise the heck out of it. If your students are anything like my students, they love those kinds of that kind of affirmation. And when somebody gets it, they want to copy that and get it for themselves. So it can be powerful.
Good. Ryan, what kinds of creative writing do you have your students create? And though I hate to ask it, how do you grade those creative writing assignments?
If I could backtrack to the person who asked me a previous question, just real quick, sorry. I did think of one more thing that I have my students do when I'm approaching an objective grading assignment. And it happens typically at the beginning of the year. I have them type out a writing assignment. It's typically an expository one. And I have them leave their name off the front of the page. And they write their name on the very back of the essay at the bottom, lightly in pencil. And this is one of the ways that I don't actually need that, but it sends them a message that I'm trying to approach their grading with what they've given me on the page. And that's just, that's one other kind of an objective approach that you can do to send a message to the students that you're not after them in any way, especially when things have to become sometimes critical. As far as the recent question, the creative writing, we have a colleague of mine and I, we've been out looking for what's the answer, because as our students hit junior year and senior year, it oftentimes, and I was talking to another gentleman in the room about this very thing this morning, it often seems like our expectation for where they should be as writers would be further than where they actually are, and we've been mystified by that, and we've talked about it throughout the years, and we've been out for a program to look for this, and one of the things that we did encounter, and several different organizations and individuals rework this, but Epithonius had developed a system of writing called the Progymnasmata, and we encountered this by a gentleman who might be selling his books here. His name is James Selby. And in this process, it's basically, it means the beginning stages or the before exercises, and this is preparing them for rhetoric. And in these steps of the progym, there are things like descriptive essays and characterization essays and writing encomiums and invectives and refutations. And it really is an excellent, excellent program to look at. And in particular, it's the description essay and the characterization essay that have a very strong creative approach as you're looking at past, present, and future, or just the way to describe something through the senses. Grading that objectively is a little bit more of a challenge. It really requires you to set out what I do personally, and there are so many different approaches, but what I do personally is I try to identify a few things that I really want to look for and then communicate back to them. So if in the description it's, I want you to hit the senses, then I'm going to be looking for that and communicating with them how well they did with really bringing in the senses, the sight of something, the smell of something, the feel of something. And characterization might be a very specific breakdown on I am looking for, in particular, how this character ethically acted in the past versus the future. And so that is more of a content or invention situation. But those are some of the ways is to try and set something up ahead of time that I'm going to be looking for in particular.
both with the motivating students and then the creative writing, this goes together, I think, and I was thinking in a different mindset a little bit when that last question, but on the games that we play with writing doesn't always have to be graded. And so I think sometimes we get in this, we get so worried about how am I going to grade it, how are they going to get a number on it, that that can kind of kill some of the fun sometimes. And so and when we do this wait, don't tell me game where there's one crazy news story and there are plenty of sources you can get these great crazy news stories from, weird news. So there's one that's written and then I have the students write up, I give them a theme. So I can say, this is the theme of these three news stories. And then, has anybody, wait, don't tell me? You need to listen to that. But then the other two news stories, so there's this theme, and then the students will write a creative little news story. It's a little story, so they're writing a very brief narrative, creatively done, and then we vote on which one is the right one, right? And so what that does is, one, it gets them to hear something that is written well, not necessarily classically, but it's written well. And they hear that, and then they're trying to imitate it. So it's imitation in writing. They're imitating what they're hearing. They're doing it not for a grade, but because they want to win. And they want someone to vote for theirs. And then they get to hear one another's writing as well, without a grade attached to it, without having to say, here's the best writer in the room, and here's the bad writer. They know, they listen, and they can tell, oh, mine didn't, I see where mine didn't work, and why it didn't work, and this guy's did work. And the whole time they're laughing at these funny stories, and so there's the building in some competition and some fun in that way. You don't always have to grade it.
In college, I took a couple creative writing courses, which is obviously a very different type of writing than the expository writing that we've been talking about. And one of the things that I picked up is, I don't know what the actual term is, but we just called them workshops, where you would write a story, you would copy that story however many times there are students in the class, you would hand that story out to the students, and then the next time you met, they had that story read, we sat in a circle, and they talked to you. And this is another way to have something not actually be graded, as Dan was talking about, but yet still get immense feedback. And it's also very interesting. And on the creative spectrum, on the creative side of things, it's often easier to do that because students will express ideas and thoughts that they have about that work. And it really, it's kind of a scary thing for the student who has done the writing to sit through it, but the process is spectacular. Not only do they pick up a lot, but everybody begins to engage in this great discussion of what's good about that writing, and so that's another effective way to sit them in a circle and to talk about a particular work.
And to clarify, I don't think either of you guys, I know for sure Dan's not, but I don't think either of them are saying nothing needs to be graded, again, for you newcomers. But they are saying something that I also believe very strongly, but it's not that everything needs to be graded. Often teachers get just stuck in that, you know, where we run into it as administrators, at least I do. I don't know if Ty does, is, you know, well, we gave our last test and there's still 3 days of school left. What can we do? Like, well, you can't teach something because there's no more grade coming. So, you know, you can teach all the time. So, Ty, as an administrator, do your writing teachers have a reduced teaching load given the amount of time that's required to grade?
You know, actually, I wish this was a plan, but it just kind of stumbled. I think the reason that we had a better senior thesis this year, the teacher that was added to the mix, we actually had 17 seniors, and we had two teachers assigned to that class. And for the last month of before the papers came in, we actually had three teachers working with students. That's about a little bit, well, 5 2/3 kind of ratio per one. But one of the things that was really kind of telling, I think, is the one of the teachers that was in the mix he's a part-time teacher. So I would getting some part-time writing expert teachers to come in sometimes is a good thing, because the classes are heavier. If it's a class that's on writing, it's a heavier, it's not always heavier. But when it's heavier, it is way heavier. So the first time we did senior thesis, I was the teacher. I took five 40-page papers home at night, told the kids I would grade them and give them feedback tomorrow. And I remember my head hitting the second paper, and I thought, I'm an idiot. So, yeah. It's heavy.
Right. Yeah, so I think that's a very common question. So I don't know, if you ask all the different administrators here, you might get different answers, but I think most of us would say we'd like to give a lighter load to certain subjects. It wouldn't be just writing. There are others that have their own kind of heaviness, but we'd like to give a lighter load to writing teachers, but I'm guessing most of us aren't yet able to do that in a proactive way. Is that true, Ty?
Yeah. Not much.
Yeah. Anybody in here, does your school give English or writing teachers a lighter load all the time, always? Yeah,
I mean, all teachers, administrators know this, all teachers complain. All
that's
teachers
right,
think,
yeah.
Number one, they think they're the most important person.
That's
And number
true.
Two, they think that they have the hardest job. But really, the writing teacher sometimes is true.
Yeah, yeah. Although I do think for writing teachers, it comes in these waves, as Ty says, whereas the math teachers, it's maybe every day they've got. I mean, so, hopefully you teach what you love and you do it because you want to do it. So then, you know, you signed the contract and go for it. But we do care. We care. Can one of you give a rundown on how you grade longer essays? Do you use rubric categories? How do you weight them, etc.? Just how do you grade longer essays, and one or any of you?
I use, because I teach using the first three canons of rhetoric, invention, arrangement, and elocution, I break up the grade into I, A, and E. And so the first time, and because we're always adding new tools to that, it depends on where we are in the process. So which essay is this? How many tools in invention have I taught them to use, and have they used them? How many, when it comes to invention, I'm looking at the ideas and how well they're developed, that sort of thing. And so within each one of those, they each have kind of their own little rubric based on which essay we're in. An arrangement, does it include a refutation? Have I taught refutation yet? in elocution, which has probably the largest number of pieces that could be there, what tropes or schemes do I expect of them in this? And that would also include things like just simple verb tense consistency or that sort of thing. So each one of those, it's kind of a growing rubric, but it is grouped as an I, an A, and an E, and each one of those can have 1 to 5. A 5 will blow me. Actually, the arrangement, a three for me is you met the expectations. So 3 threes is met the expectations. And that's just if you get a 4, you went above and beyond. So maybe an arrangement only goes to 4 because I've had a hard time seeing how you can blow me away with your arrangement. I can see how you can do something a little extra. Maybe the snake eating its tail kind of coming back full circle. That's a neat, there's some neat devices you can use there. And maybe you really did a really snappy job with arrangement. You'll get a 4. But invention and elocution, you went above and beyond what was required. You get a 4. You really blew me away. You get a 5 in those. And then I have a bell. Those numbers correspond to a bell curve where the vast majority, 9, is right in the middle. And as they get older, so a 9 would be you met the expectations, 3 in every category. And as I begin in 9th grade with that being in a mid to high B range, with everything belled around, most of the grades at B, a few, and then as they get older, that a 9 goes down to a B minus. Back in our day, it would have been a C, right? But maybe it should be still. I don't know. But a B minus if they've met the expectations, if that's it. And then it's easy to get a C or even a low B. It's difficult to get an A.
Okay, guys, we've got 10 minutes left, so as much as possible, we'll go into speed round here. How's that? So this is for Ryan. What kind of practice does a good writing teacher assign his students?
In my class, we're consistently responding to the literature that we read. And so I've developed these things in my class called theme exercises, which basically amounts to a sheet of paper that I hand out, and on that sheet of paper are a couple sentences of directions, and there is then a paragraph from the previous night's reading. And this paragraph is usually from a pretty meaty section of the text, which has some powerful ideas and themes in it, and I just have them respond. It's somewhat of a free structure. It's somewhat of a invention-oriented scenario where they just get their ideas out, get the content out, and this is constant. We do several of these in a week and in a month to just get them to experience what it means to respond to literature, to get some ideas out, because it's in thinking, it's in writing oftentimes where some new connections happen and they realize things. And slowly over the year, these become more and more organized, and we get more at the arrangement or the organization of it. But that's one of the things that we do that's pretty consistent.
Okay, Dan Doherty, when you give students room to invent, are you looking for a formal outline or just a quick set of bullet points? What role does the outline play, if any, in the process of writing? So.
Right. When I give them room to invent, when I mentioned that was on a test itself. And I would expect to see somewhat of a rough outline there, but nothing too elaborate. What I'm really looking for is, are they using some of the tools? So some of the invention tools that we use are things like circumstance or comparison, and there's some little diagrammy ways that I help them to do that. And so I want to see that they're engaging their mind and they're thinking it through on that, and the invention, when I give them room for that on a test. The outline portion really is arrangement. It's not so much invention at that point. You're arranging your ideas. And so for papers, yes, I do expect a full-on outline. And you walk through, don't have really time, but there's some great steps and some great tools to go from invention to arrangement, and to take your invention, to group it together and make it an outline. And by that time, you're essay is all but written. I mean, definitely outline's a very important part.
Ty, what should you expect from 7th and 8th graders? What should you expect them to be able to do by the end of the year regarding their writing skills?
I tell you what I would really like out of 7th and 8th graders is one good paragraph. One good paragraph that actually answers a question. Like, My biggest problem for my 7th and 8th graders, a lot of times, they just want to say true things. You give them a question, and they blurt true things out. Because I guess that in grammar school, we've trained them to blurt true things out. So, but what I want, if they can give me one paragraph, I ask them a question, they can give me one paragraph that answers the question, that provides proof, like that logically supports their thesis statement, and then rounds it off nicely. That's all I want. That's all. Like if you can, there's some of them you can get more than that. I would love to get that, be able to get that consistently out of 7th and 8th graders. And I think it fits with kind of the logic, because really the logic of writing, there's a broader logic that you talked about with arrangement in essays and thesis papers. But I think that a lot of times our kids fail to understand the logic of a paragraph. And that's kind of, if they can write decent sentences and put them together in a logical paragraph, their 7th and 8th graders, they're in the 99th percentile at that point.
I'd like you all to answer this one, but keep in mind we're running out of time. So we got 5 minutes.
Yes.
What skills do you focus on when teaching students to peer edit? Peer edit.
I think some of the primary skills that I want the students to focus on are directly what we are working on. And at the beginning of the year, we start with the points that they're developing and making them personal. And so I want the students to be able to respond to one another based on points. Oftentimes we get, if we're not teaching point, what I see at the freshman level is if I want them to write an essay on or a paragraph on honor in the Iliad, what the point will look like is there's a lot of honor in the Iliad, right? And so what we're trying to do is get them beyond that point, and we're trying to let's make it more personal. What is it about honor that you see? What is it about this text that plays into that, and address that? And then in particular, we also talk about the illustrations, which are the actual examples that they're taking from the book. I want them to respond to one another based on, are these good? Are these lofty? Are they subtle? Is this the example that we talked about 25,000 times in class? Or is this a new one that's very fresh and that you found, and it's subtle, it's excellent, it's good? And then finally, the explanation section is very difficult to address. And so we start with just, do they come back to explain to you how that illustration shows the point? And if you can hit those things, those are the primary things that we focus on.
I think that's really good. I want students to be able to help other students see, like, you know those times when you write something and it makes sense in your head, but it actually doesn't make any sense to anyone else? Just to have them to be sensitive to help folks pick out and see those awkward, idiosyncratic kind of ways of writing.
Yeah, checklist rubric, that's similar but abbreviated from the one that I'll use. But I also like to have them read out loud to one another rather than just reading one another silently, because I want them to learn to read out loud on their own when they go home. I tell them everything you write you should read out loud, and sometimes you'll catch on your own, oh, this doesn't make sense. but they don't read out loud on their own often because that feels a little weird. So if you have them, when I have them, I don't do a ton of peer editing, and maybe listen to these guys, maybe I'll do more of that. But when I do, it's they're reading it out loud, and that's the thing I'll focus on the most, is reading out loud to one another.
Okay, I'm going to combine two questions. They're not the same, but I think they are closely related. How can grammar school teachers best prepare their students for logic and rhetoric stage writing? And then how can teachers themselves become better educated as writers? And if everybody can answer that quickly. Yeah.
I'll take the better stab at the last part of it, and that is, I think as administrators, we're going to have to set aside more time to help our teachers become better writers so that they can help our students become better writers. So I think that's got to be key and critical as we move this movement forward.
Writing the same assignments that I give my students oftentimes helps quite a bit. There's not always time to do this, but when we uncovered this Pro Gymnast Mater program, there's a step in it called Crea Maxim, and I try to write a Crea Maxim a couple a month, and it is a very vigorous sort of thing that puts you in very specific steps and really pushes you toward being creative because you have limited amount of sentences and things to say. And I highly recommend it. I highly recommend placing yourself in a position where you are writing. I write with them as they write these theme exercises, and I have a blast doing it, and they see it. And then we read them out loud at times, and sometimes they ask me to read mine. And oftentimes, you know, theirs are pointed and powerful and better. And I'm meandering here and there. But it's fun because we're seeing the process unfold and we're talking about it. And so I'd say placing myself in that position as much as possible.
For the first one, the grammar, that's a great question, and it's one that we're talking, as upper school teachers, we've been talking more and more to our lower school teachers in trying to figure out how do we make, you know, what's the gap between the surely chance and the actually making it work in a sentence, and how do we connect that? And so right now we're just talking about that there's the something needs to be done more there, I think. I don't have any great advice there. And if you want to have teachers that write better, then have teachers write. Just write.
You're talking about the Progum Nazmata, it looks like Classical Academic Press has some new stuff on that that's pretty interesting looking. And then, of course, my favorite examples on the Progum Nazmata are on the Brigham Young University website. Yeah, BYU. Yeah, who's going to advocate that at this conference? But you go to the BYU website, and it makes sense. Yeah, the Mormons do a heck of a job on rhetoric sometime. And so. I'm not sure if it is, but if you type in Progum Nazmata and Brigham Young University, it'll take you to probably the most helpful website that I found out there.
So just one of you answer this if you have a good, strong opinion or answer, but how do you suggest implementing language development in non-literary classes, for example, math?
Language development? What do you mean?
I think they're talking, I would guess, they're talking about how much writing should be done, how do you help writing to occur there? Am I on nod heads?
Science, you know, like we're going to, you think this panel's fun. I'm the moderator on the Origins panel later in the week, so that's going to be great. But I think that when you come to a controversial point, having an essay where you're trying to convince or persuade is excellent for science. We've done this a few times at my school where, I was a pretty good math student. I went pretty far in math. But I stopped understanding math conceptually at when I got to calculus, really. And so I have my students, my math teacher sometimes will have his students write an essay trying to persuade me that they can tell me what calculus is. Mm-hmm. So I go in and listen, and then I shake my head and go back to my office. But that... trying to look for opportunities, because if they can get to the point where they can explain what calculus is, they really understand calculus.
Right. Yep.
Phil Arand, I'm going to call him out. Stand up there, Phil. Phil's our science teacher, and in eighth grade, he has at the end of every one of his units, he has them write a letter to a friend that explains the unit, and they have to use Aristotle's methods of persuasion. And so you can talk to Phil about incorporating writing into science.
Is it a real friend or a fake friend?
No, a real friend.
Real friend, okay.
I do want to emphasize, especially because I know there's new folks here and this classical stuff can seem, you know, overwhelming. It is science class or it is math class. It's not English or writing class. So, you know, you don't expect the English teacher to be teaching equations. But... of course, all the knowledge is related. You don't want to send the message that it doesn't matter. You know, math doesn't matter outside of math class, and writing doesn't matter outside of writing class. But you only have, depends on your school, 45, 50 minutes, and there's a lot to do in all of these different classes. We're 4 minutes over time. This is the last question. If you need to leave, go ahead, but I think we can get through this one. How do you teach argumentation? I think this is for Dan. How do you teach argumentation, developing the explanations part of their writing? Oh, sorry. Ryan. Sorry. Yeah.
The explanation part of the PI acronym that I use is the challenging one. And at first I try to limit them to the amount of sentences they can use, because this is where I find the wandering. This is where I find the drifting. And so tightening it up on them, you hear quite a bit of fussing. When you limit the amount of sentences that they have to communicate to you, not only the interpretation of the text, but also how then that shows the point, and maybe doing something classically here, like drawing an analogy or making a comparison or giving some kind of a praise or some kind of a refute, this is challenging, and it requires that they pull out the compound complex sentence, and it requires that they understand their grammar. And this is where we really get to where the rubber meets the road when we talk about the grading. So the explanation portion at first is me just labeling pie on the board and saying, this is your illustration, which is the text right from the book, and you can either embed that quote or you can introduce that quote. I want words from the author. And then when you get to the explanation section, I not only want to know why that is important, but I also want to see how it makes your point. I want you to make that connection, and it typically takes a minimum of 2 sentences. And when I get a student that comes up and says, Mr. Baker, I can't give 2 sentences for this particular chunk, this illustration, then I say, your illustration is too obvious. Your illustration is too basic. It's too surface. There's nothing that you can even say about it. And so that's problematic. So that then, when they're struggling with the explanation section, I know that oftentimes, sometimes it relates to the illustration that they chose. So it's good. But
I'd like to thank our panelists. I think all of their email contact information is in the outline or part. And so, yes, give them applause. I'm sure they'd be glad to share their rubrics and things with you by email if you contact them. Thank you for coming. Good questions.